We've made our way now to the second of the post-exilic books, the book of Ezekiel. Actually, some might call this the second of three post-exilic books. Some people would consider Book of Lamentations post-exilic because it was written right after the fall of Jerusalem. But it was written right there at Jerusalem. So we normally, when we think of, did I say post-exilic? I meant exilic. When we think of exilic books, we normally think of two, Ezekiel and Daniel. But some would also put Lamentations in there. Not ED, but LED, lead, you know. I normally will put those Lamentations, kind of attach it more to Jeremiah. But in this session, we go to Ezekiel. And I have, I have a bunch and bunch of slides on Ezekiel. I think I'm going to get, I was actually showing you the one right there that was for Old Testament survey. Let me keep that one for another time. If you need more details about Ezekiel, you can go to the Old Testament survey one. But actually, I think it's better to try to be more abbreviated in this. So I'm going to go to the one on Old Testament preaching, all right, that I'm calling Be Expectant, also with Ezekiel. This one will have less detail, but I think it'll, since we only have, 40 minutes or so to cover it, we'll be able to get through the book a lot more easily. When we think of being expectant, we think of being expectant maybe like for a baby, right? I was so happy to see my daughter-in-law expectant earlier this year. But that's not the type of expectancy we're talking about. We're talking about having an expectancy to see God's glory in a way that we have never, ever seen before as we look at the book of Ezekiel. Our key word for this book is glory. And a lot of us, you can look back in your life and you can remember the glory period of your life. And yet the glory has actually departed. I hope you don't feel that way. I hope you don't look back at your time at Singapore Bible College and say, yeah, that was when the glory departed, I hope you'll look back with a sense of, wow, that was a time I really got to, just really know the Lord better. I kind of, I joke about this in my time at Dallas Seminary when I had my 3.5 years of my THM and my 3.5 years of my PhD. I fondly refer to it as my 7-year tribulation, but it really wasn't. It was a lot of hard work, and it did last 7 years, and it was divided right up in the middle. But I don't think of that as the time of the glory days of the past, when I was a student. I love being a professor as much as I love being a student, because both of them relate to the Word of God. But think about how people have seen the glory pass in their lives. To see a boulder come and smash their home, all their hope, this is a huge boulder the size of a house. Or a runner whose dream was to win the Olympic race and then ended up pulling a hamstring or whatever. Of the baseball player who misses a very easy catch, of a relationship that's gone sour, of, losing a position or seeing the glory days, militarily or whatever in their past, and maybe even in terms of their time with the Lord. A lot of us, we've seen those times in the past. Those days go by. Ezekiel certainly did. He was a young man who grew up in the land of Israel. He had gone to the temple many, many times. Solomon's temple. Imagine the most amazing building ever built. And that was during his lifetime. He was able to go there. But then the Lord plucked him up pulled him out of his land. Sound a little familiar? Kind of sounds like the last book we studied, Daniel, right? But Ezekiel was older than Daniel. Daniel was a teenager, probably 14, 15 years old. Ezekiel was 30 years old. He begins his book. He says, in the 30th year, in the fourth month, and the fifth day, while I was among the exiles in the Kabar River, the heavens were open and I saw visions of God. So he actually was, maybe you could say, twice as old as Daniel when all that happened. But God gave him a vision of the glory, and I think it can be very helpful for us as we look to the future as well. So our hope is in God, but when God removes his glory and his presence, this sense of his presence in our lives, we need to know what to do. And so I think the question, how can you be expectant of God's glory once again in your life, is a question that Ezekiel was facing. And it can be a question that we face as well. I was talking to a student last week, and he said, I'm just not so sure I'm going to continue. He said, I just don't have the joy of studying. And I said, can you give it two more weeks? Let's get to the end of this cycle here, the end of this semester and stuff. And he's trying to think on how can he be expectant to see God's glory and this joy kind of come back in his life. At times in our lives, the book of Ezekiel is a really good book to go to, because it will tell us, in light of wrath and sin and disobedience and all the things that the people had experienced, how God can show himself to be heavy again, to be weighty again. This is what the word glory means. And Ezekiel and Daniel certainly needed to see that. They had seen the Babylonians make their way from Babylon all the way across nation after nation, right up to their nation, right up to the gates of Jerusalem. And they'd heard how that happened, but both of these brothers were taken away from the land and taken back to Babylon before the city was actually destroyed. They were in our page 1 or 492, I guess it would be in your notes. We have the 6 deportations of the Babylonians, some minor, some major. Daniel was taken in the first of those in 605 BC, along with 3 friends, other nobility. And the Babylonians kind of left them alone for a little bit, let them, wanted to find out, are you guys going to pay your money, your protection money, so to speak? And they didn't do it. They went to Egypt. They tried to find that Egypt could provide some security for them. So Babylonians came in a couple more times, 598. And 597 was a big one. 598, 3,000 people taken. 597, 10,000 people taken. And it was at this time that Ezekiel was taken. Ezekiel didn't know that there were 3 more times the Babylonians would come to his homeland and also take people. But and then the land would actually be ruined in 586. So I don't know if he knew that. I presume that he knew only what the Lord was telling him here in the book of Ezekiel that we're going to be looking at. So the context of when Ezekiel begins his prophecy is when Jeremiah and Daniel were also speaking for the Lord. And it was a very turbulent time with the puppet kings lasting just for 3 months, Jehoahaz and Jehoiachin. But mostly during the time of Jehoiakim and Zedekiah, the last 2 kings who served for about 11 years. Very, very turbulent time. If you can imagine being taken away from your homeland to another country, and the enemy keeps coming back to your homeland and taking your people away, and you wonder, is the place even going to get destroyed? Is the glory going to actually be returned, then you can understand a little bit what it would be like to be Ezekiel. How could he respond? How should he respond? And how can you be expectant of God's glory once again in your life? I see the book in three movements or three steps of expectancy. And one of them, the first one, is to admit that God's glory left. Through the entire book of Ezekiel, we see Ezekiel longing for God's glory, longing to see God's glory. He actually sees it in an amazing way in chapter 1. But it's in a vision. It's not in reality. It's not like he's seeing that there in Babylon in his own experience. And it's actually not even happening in Jerusalem. In these first 24 chapters, God gives Ezekiel a pretty strong glimpse of how the glory was actually leaving the land. And he needed to admit the reality, to admit that God's glory had left. The people needed to admit that. They didn't get to see what he got to saw in chapter 1, where God's glory departs. Or God's glory in this first section departs. Actually departs around chapter 10 and chapter 11. But in this first section, we see how God and why God was judging the land. These people were in the temple itself getting caught up in idolatry. Now, just to remember where the glory actually came from, we saw God's glory very early in the second verse of the Bible where God's Spirit was dwelling over the waters. We saw God's glory come and indwell the tabernacle. God was saying, "My presence is among you. You have built the palace for me." The tabernacle was a place set up for him to dwell as king. And so God's glory actually came and entered the Holy of Holies there at the end of the book of Exodus. And I've talked before about how the word tabernacle can actually be translated. It's not really so much a place, a house where you go worship God somewhere else, a house where God lives. It's a palace where God lives. And then we see God's glory, the Spirit coming on different people in the Old Testament, judges, prophets, priests, not so much priests as much, but judges, prophets, and kings. And then when the temple is built, the glory of God goes from the tabernacle over into the temple. But Ezekiel needed to see more than that. He needed to see God's glory in a very, very powerful way. And so when he was 30 years old, that's what I think the first verse of Ezekiel is actually talking about. In the 30th year, he's talking about his own age. This is what he sees while he's there in Babylon. He sees this depiction of the glory of God. He says, "I looked," verse 4, "and I saw a windstorm coming out of the north, an immense cloud with flashing lightning and surrounded by brilliant light. And the center of the fire looked like glowing metal, and the fire was what looked like four living beings, four living creatures." And he explains in verse 10, he says, "Each had the face of a human in the front, the face of a lion on the right side, the face of an ox on the left side, and the face of an eagle at the back." Well, what would you do if you saw four creatures like that and just, you know? "As I looked at these," he says in verse 15, "I saw four wheels touching the ground beside them, one wheel belonging to each. The wheels sparkled as if made in beryl, and all four wheels looked alike and were made the same, and each wheel had a second wheel turning crosswise within it." The artists have tried to depict what this would look like with these four beings with kind of a four-part heads and eyes and wings and all of this. and these wheels, it's a very, very difficult one to depict. But this is what he sees, and he realized this is the glory of God. He says at the very last verse, this of verse of chapter 1, this was the appearance of the likeness of the glory of the Lord. And when I saw it, I fell face down and I heard the voice of one speaking. You ever seen the glory of God? Not like this, I suspect. But he needed to see in his own situation, being pulled from his land, that God was still a God of glory, that God was still a God who was concerned for them. And so this voice speaks to him and actually doesn't tell him very encouraging news. Chapter 2, verse 3. Son of man, he said, I'm sending you to the nation of Israel, a rebellious nation that has rebelled against me. They and their ancestors have been rebelling against me to this very day. They're a stubborn, hard-hearted people, but I'm sending you to them to say to them, this is what the sovereign Lord says. Okay, put yourself there. God says, I'm going to give you a whole bunch of counselees, 137 counselees. Not one of them is going to listen to a word you say in your counseling sessions. I'm giving you a congregation of 397 people, and you're going to be the music minister of this congregation. You're going to try to lead them in worship of God, and they're not going to care about worshiping God, but that's your job, to lead them in worship. I'm leading you to be a teacher of 495 students at I shouldn't say what school, you know. This is definitely not this school. And I want you to tell the people what I say, but just let me know. I'll just let you know in advance. Whatever you say, they're just not going to listen. They're stubborn. They're rebellious. But once you graduate, this is my assignment for you. You know, God gave me an assignment like that. I graduated with my master's. And I immediately started, well, even before I started graduated, I immediately started pastoring a church. And long story, it was a short pastor with a long story. I was there less than a year. And I found that I was like Ezekiel. I was in this situation where, wow, these people want to come to church, but they really didn't. They had split off from another church and they were very disgruntled with the previous church. And I found I could not heal them. I could not bring them out of that. I stayed less than a year. It was my goal to take the church of 50 and build it to 500, then come to Asia and tell you all how to do it. Because I heard stories like that, you know. I thought, well, if I'm going to be a seminary professor, I really should be a pastor first. And I found that God's plan for me was to take this church of 50 and build it to 25. You know, I think I may have told you that in one of the other class sessions. But and I saw half of the people leave. And it was like the glory had gone. And I thought, wow, God. You know, one encouragement I had in it is that I was actually given an award at my graduation, just before I, like 2 weeks, 3 weeks before I resigned from the church, that I held to the ideals of the seminary. It was a faculty award, you know, for Christian leadership, for academics and that sort of thing, a character award. So they give me this very coveted award, and within a month, I'm resigning my church. And I thought, wow. I was like an Ezekiel, or I was like a Jeremiah. Actually, you could kind of put any one of the prophets' names in there, can't you? Because it was a stubborn audience for every one of them. And yet, God calls us to be to serve him. He even signifies the siege when we get to chapter 4. So Ezekiel's preaching to these people that are also brought into exile with him. And the Lord tells him to symbolize Jerusalem under attack. Remember, Jerusalem hadn't been destroyed by this time. Ezekiel was brought there in advance. And so God tells him, I want you to go there, and I want you to diagram the siege for me in front of all the people, okay? Like an object lesson. Because he didn't have PowerPoint back then, you see. And so what he had to do is he had to somehow figure out how to do it. So he tells them, okay, publicly go to before the people. This is chapter 4 here. Take a clay tablet, put it in front of you. Okay, I don't have a clay tablet, but let's say these notes right here is my clay tablet. All right, so I've got my clay tablet. There's the city of Jerusalem. You get the idea? And then lay siege to it. Lay siege to it, okay? Erect siege works against it. What kind of siege works do I have here? Oh, yeah, here's one of the siege works here. And we need what? Battering rams? Yeah. Let's see if I got some battering rams. Here's a battering ram, you know? So I'm going to put these battering rams against my city of Jerusalem here. And then take an iron pan and place it between you and the city. I didn't bring my iron pan, so I'll put my iron coffee cup between me and the city. He's doing all this before the people. And it'll be a sign to the house of Israel. And then he says, then lie on your left side. Okay, so I got to lie on my left side. All right, this is the left side. So, all right, got to lie on my left side. Okay, Lord, what else do you want me to do now? And you are to bear their sin for the number of days you lie on your side. Did he say days? I'm lying on my side for days, not minutes, not hours. No, days. Okay, how many days? I've assigned for you the number of days of the years of their sin. So for 390 days, you'll bear the sin of the house of Israel. That's like three semesters, friends, you know, put an R. I'm gonna teach like this for three semesters. I'm going to preach against this little model of Jerusalem here in front of me. And I bet you'll remember it. That's what God was telling the people. Ezekiel, you're going to do this for 390 days. And after you finish this, lie down again. This time on your right side. Okay, the right side. Well, my left side's getting kind of sore 390 days. So I think, okay, so now I'm going to lie down on my right side. Lord, please, not 390 days, right? And he says, no, this is only 40 days, just a month. Turn your face toward the Jerusalem and with a bared arm prophesy it against it. You stupid city, why don't you know who your God is? You know? Look at all the siege works around it. The Babylonians are surrounding you. What a picture. And over, God's asking Ezekiel to do these types of things. He did some similar things like with Jeremiah. Go get your underwear and bury it between two rocks at the Euphrates River. I mean, seriously, God, really? So he leaves Jerusalem, goes all the way through Judah, Israel, Syria, all the way up the Euphrates. It would take him weeks to get there. Bury his underwear there and then make his way back to Jerusalem. And then God says, oh, now that you're back, now go back there and see how your underwear is doing, you know? Seriously? Some of the things that God asks us to do. Yeah. Why? Because they had taken the position and all that God had given them, and they had really squandered it. God had given Israel a very strategic position. From Europe, from Asia, from Africa, the land of Israel had really the most coveted position geographically of all the nations. They were at the crossroads of the world there. And so he says in Ezekiel 5:5, "Thus says the Lord God, this is Jerusalem. I set her in the center of the nations, with countries round about her." In other words, you guys are just squandering all the blessings I've given you. You know? And that makes me think about the thought question, how has God placed you in a strategic place for his purposes? What is true of you, really, that could not be said of anyone else in this room? Every one of us has a unique place before God. We have unique opportunities. We speak a language maybe no one else speaks, or maybe few speak in the room. And even if there are others who speak Chinese or Thai or whatever language you're speaking, things are not the same. You have opportunities, you have gifts, you have abilities that others don't have, because God has a strategic plan for your life, you know? The sad thing is, though, the people squandered what God had given them. And he said he was not going to dwell with the people that would live in sin. So I'm going to jump to chapter 8, where we find that it says that he reached out what seemed to be a hand and took me by the hair. So here's Ezekiel in Babylon getting grabbed by the hair and taken over to Jerusalem. Okay? This is a different way to fly than normally most of us fly today. Thank God we don't have to fly by our hair, right? And what does God show him? He brings him to the north gate of the inner temple, where there's a large idol that made the Lord very jealous. They've got an idol in the temple itself. And suddenly, the glory of the Lord, of the God of Israel, is there. So the glory of God that's normally there at the Holy of Holies ends up on the north side. That's kind of interesting. So in other words, God's glory had left the Holy of Holies and had moved to the north side. And then we see him in chapter 9, verse 3, see the glory of God move again. Notice what it says. Now the glory of the God of Israel went from above the cherubim where it had been and moved to the threshold of the temple. So is the glory of God going to be on the north gate? Is it going to be over the Holy of Holies, or is it going to be over the threshold? It's like God's glory keeps shifting places here. It's not staying where normally he would stay, there in the Holy of Holies. You get into chapter 10. Ezekiel sees another vision. The glory evidently had gone back over the cherubim there in the Holy of Holies. But chapter 10, verse 3 says, "Now the cherubim were standing on the south side of the temple when the man came in." So they had gone to the south side, and the glory of God rose from above the cherubim and moved to the threshold of the temple. All right? The cloud filled the temple, and the court was full of the radiance of the glory of the Lord. So here's God's glory now in the courtyard, or giving radiance to the whole courtyard. Kind of a back and forth sort of thing. Verse 18. "And then the glory of the Lord departed from over the threshold of the temple and stopped above the cherubim. And while I watched, the cherubim spread their wings and rose from the ground as they went. And the wheels went with them. They stopped at the entrance to the east gate of the Lord's house." So they're there at the threshold. Let's go to the Holy of Holies and go back over. Now they're over the east gate. It looks like God's glory is just about to leave the whole temple courtyard, doesn't it? Indeed, it actually happens. Because when we get into chapter 11, God's glory that is there at the eastern gate actually departs the entire temple area. Ezekiel 11:23. "The glory of the Lord went from within the city and stopped above the mountain east of it." So God's glory goes across the Kidron Valley and ends up on the Mount of Olives. You see this? It's almost like God's glory is sort of going back and forth. Should I leave the Holy of Holies? Should I leave the threshold? Should I leave the temple compound? I'm not going to dwell with a sinful people. God gives Ezekiel a vision of these people worshiping the sun. They're there in the temple. They've got their backs to the temple, and they're worshiping the sun. And God says, I'm not going to put up with people like that. Ezekiel needed to recognize that God was just in having the glory depart from the land. And I think for us, we need to be honest that while the Spirit is present, that we may have quenched him. And, you know, a lot of times people will come to us and say, you know, where's the Lord's glory gone in my life? And you ask a little bit, you'll find out that they've made many, many compromises. And now we still have the indwelling of the Spirit. I don't believe that God's Holy Spirit goes in and out of our lives. I don't think that that's a parallel here. Jesus said in John 14, I'll give you another counselor to be with you forever. The issue for us is not that God's Spirit indwells us and doesn't indwell us, etc. The issue is more of quenching the Spirit. Literally, that means putting out the Spirit's fire, like just extinguishing a candle. And believers can do that, and you and I have known that. People have done that. Maybe you've done that yourself in your own life. And so how can you be expectant of God's glory once again in your life? I think the first step is to admit that God's glory is left. Admit that we have sinned and the Lord has pulled back from us, even though he longs to be with us. But we also need to allow God to handle all rivals to his glory. If you want to have him restore that sense of blessing that you used to have, we need to allow him to take care of all the others that are actually taking the place of God in our lives. And that's what we see in this center section beginning of chapter 25. It's interesting, the glory of God is mentioned several times in chapters 1 to 24, but the word glory, kavod, the Hebrew, is not mentioned at all in chapters 25 to 32. There's no glory. Why? Because we see all these various nations here that did not have the glory of God, but God was going to take care of those various nations. And these were basically rivals, Ammon, Moab, Edom. You go into these chapters and you'll see that the Lord has a message for each one of these nations that would be judged. These nations that were tempting his people. And they were following their gods rather than following the God of Israel. But he says, I'm going to take care of them, including Tyre that we see in chapter 28. Tyre was the most amazing, the wealthiest city of antiquity, right on the eastern Mediterranean. But it had colonies that went all along North Africa, all the way over to Tarshish or Spain, and into Sardinia and Sicily. And they had the best ships. They had the best trade. Tyre was the wealthiest place. And we see Tyre's king, who regarded himself as a god, depicted in Ezekiel 28, where Ezekiel says, Son of man, give the prince of Tyre this message from the sovereign Lord. In your great pride, you claim, I am a god. I sit in a divine throne in the heart of the sea. But you're only a man and not a god, though you boast that you are a god. Later on, Poseidon put a temple right up there, up above Tyre, you know, in the Greek god of the sea. There's a debate here among scholars as to whether this is actually talking about the king of Tyre, because it seems like the same, that language is used in respect to Satan being cast down in Revelation 12. And Ezekiel continues going on. He says, Son of man, give the Prince of Tyre, this message from the Sovereign Lord. In your great pride, you claim I'm a god. Right? So, and God's saying, no, you're not a god. He says, you regard yourself wiser than Daniel. This is I find a very helpful passage right here. Because remember, a lot of people are saying that Daniel didn't really live during this time. He didn't really write his prophecy during this time. We see Ezekiel and Daniel being associated together at this same time. But this prince of Tyre became very, very proud. And then he goes back in verse 14. You are the model of perfection, full of wisdom and exquisite beauty. Or verse 12 and 13. You were in Eden, the garden of God. Your rich commerce led you to violence. So anyway, the end of verse 17 says, I threw you to the ground and exposed you to the curious gaze of kings. Is this talking about the fall of Tyre? Or is this talking about Satan? Or is it talking about both? Or neither, or someone else? You know, there's all these kinds of views on this. I think he's actually depicting the fall of the king of Tyre, but it's in a greater fulfillment. He's actually talking about what had happened much earlier at Satan's fall. And in any case, the point here is that God's glory will not shine with competitors in your life. And he needed to take Israel, these temptations out of Israel's way. Brian, what's your thought?
Any relation to any of the tribes?
Tyre was close to the tribe of Asher. It was up in the north, so Tyre was the place where the... Yeah, go ahead.
Tyre is something new.
Well, it's not part of Israel. We're looking at the Phoenicians that were just north of Israel. But there was obviously a lot of trade. Tyre was a place where they got the cedar logs for the temple. And there was a lot of trade between David and Tyre and Solomon and Hiram of Tyre. And some intermarriage up there as well going on. But this is in Phoenicia is where the god Baal was worship, and Baal worship ended up coming down into Israel and to some extent down into Judah as well. So God was taking care, God was going to conquer not only Israel and Judah, but he was going to conquer all these other nations as well. He did so through the Assyrians before this time, and he was going to do so again through the Babylonians that conquered all these people. Okay, so for this idea of expectancy, how can we be expectant of God's glory once again returning? We need to admit that God's glory had left. The people needed to acknowledge that. They need to acknowledge their sin. They need to allow God to handle all the rivals to his throne. They didn't have to conquer those nations. God himself was raising up the Babylonians to conquer those nations. But God would handle them. And then the third step is to anticipate. These are the three A's you can see. To admit, to allow, and to anticipate. Anticipate God's glory to return. The book doesn't end there. The glory's left Israel and you guys are, everything's hopeless and sorry, you know. What we find in the third section of Ezekiel is the return of God's glory. So the word glory appears many times in this section as well, chapters 33 to 48. So here God is restoring his blessing on Israel. And he talks about a new life he was going to give the nation and actually a new order, including a new temple and sacrificial system and all that. But he appoints Ezekiel to be the one to tell the people about the restoration. It's sort of like thinking in terms of how would you restore an old painting, you know? Why would there need to be a restoration? God had actually promised a restoration to Israel. He promised them that they would have their land. It still hadn't been fulfilled to the borders that God had promised to Abraham. He promised them, remember to Jeremiah, to give them a new heart. a heart of flesh. We see the similar thing. Jeremiah 31 is parallel to Ezekiel 36 here. And God had promised to restore their ability to keep his word. He had done that with Jeremiah, and he was going to do that here. So Ezekiel 36 is really one of the key chapters here that talks about the glory of the new covenant. And we find some more details here in Ezekiel that we don't find in Jeremiah about the new covenant. But these are the two prophets that tell us about the new covenant more than any other. Under the new covenant, they would be restored to the land, cleansed from sin, have a responsive heart to God, not a heart of stone, but a heart of flesh. They have the indwelling of the Spirit, a motivation and ability for obedience. The Spirit is talked about in Ezekiel in relationship to the new covenant, whereas we don't find Jeremiah is talking so much about the Holy Spirit, not like Ezekiel did. But this restoration of the land was a big one, because remember, Ezekiel's away from the land, wondering about his people coming on back. And God prophesies in Ezekiel 37 that he would bring his people back to the land. Now, I don't think that's actually going to happen except in association with Christ's return. Ultimately, the people will be restored to the land. And in terms of looking for signs of Jesus' return, technically, I don't think we really have the signs of his return except in the tribulation itself. Because I take it that Jesus could come at any moment. The New Testament teaches that many places. Which is called the imminency, or that Jesus could have come at any time. So I don't think there necessarily have to be signs of Christ's return to take us in the clouds, but I think there definitely has to be signs of him coming back and restoring his kingdom. But could God really do that? I mean, think about that. I mean, what other nation have you ever heard of that was destroyed, kicked out of their homeland, lost their language, their ancient language, and yet did not intermarry with the nations and was returned centuries later, even millennia later, back to their land? You know, I suspect a lot of you probably know more about world history than I do, but I don't think there's any people of world history that have ever seen that happen to them. Where they've been kicked out of their land, they actually return, like Israel has, some 1,900 years later. Can God do it? We should never ask the question, well, can God do this? Of course, the answer is always yes, right? In fact, God would use the most amazing means to bring his people back to the land. He would raise up a guy named Adolf Hitler, who probably hated Jews more than anyone in history, to be the one who motivated Jews to go back to their homeland. Hitler was a motivator, you understand, right? Quite a motivator. Do it or die was his strategy. And he motivated Jews to go to their homeland. From Germany, 33,400 Jews went over to the land of Palestine. Many others went to other lands as well. But what we find happening actually in chapter 37 is a depiction of the restoration of Israel through the vision of dry bones. Ezekiel is brought to this valley and he sees this whole valley of dry bones. He probably has no idea what these bones are all about, but the angel initiates, he's getting a little tour, you see. And the angel initiates the whole thing with a question. It says, "Son of man, can these bones live?" What a great question, huh? Can God do something? It's almost a silly question. God can do anything he wants to do, right? But he doesn't say yes. You should say yes, right? He says, "Well, oh Lord God, you know." It's a very helpful answer there, isn't it? Oh, sovereign Lord, you alone know. Well, that's not the issue. The issue isn't whether the Lord knows. The issue is whether Ezekiel knows. sort of like a final exam. You know? The issue isn't whether I know on the final exam the answers. The issue, you know, hopefully I do know the answers. I do take these exams, you know. I'll write the exam and then I'll take it and see what my score is. And hopefully I do well on it. If I don't, then I don't. I try to change some of the questions, you know. But don't try this one. Oh, Dr. Rick, you know. You know? Don't try that. Don't try that on the final exam, you know. I want to give you a little space to type in your answer there. The Valley of Dry Bones, he sees all these bones all over the place. And I wonder if he even really knows what's happening here. But the angel says, prophesy to these bones, say to them, dry bones, hear to the word of the Lord. This is what the sovereign Lord says to these bones. I will make breath enter you, and you will come to life, and I will attach tendons to you, and make flesh come upon you, and cover you with skin. Wow. I mean, we see bodies decay, right? You've got, but we don't see, you start with bones, and then you get muscles, and then you get flesh over them, and then he says, and I'll put breath in you, and you'll come to life, and then you'll know that I'm the Lord. Well, I bet so. I mean, we can kill people, but we can't take a dead body and a dead skeleton and make it alive. But God can. So he does this. I prophesied as I was commanded. And as I was prophesying, there was a noise, a rattling sound, and the bones came together, bone to bone. I looked, and tendons and flesh appeared on them, and skin covered them, but there's no breath in them. So they're still, you know, they're still dead, basically. Now let's see, were they standing here? No, they weren't standing. So they're just laying there, but they have the flesh and everything on them. So here's the second step. He says, come from the four winds, prophesy breath, prophesy to the breath. Wow. Come from the four winds, O breath, and breathe into these slain that they may live. So I prophesied as he commanded me, and breath entered them, and they came to life and stood on their feet, a vast army. All right, what does it mean? We don't have to wonder what it means, because God gives the interpretation. These bones are the whole house of Israel. They say, our bones are dried up and our hope is gone. We're cut off. Therefore prophesy and say to them, this is what the sovereign Lord says. Oh, my people, I'm going to open your graves and bring you up from them. I will bring you back to the land of Israel. And then you, my people, will know that I am the Lord when I open your graves and bring you up from them. You got it? God's going to bring, step one is to bring this nation back. Connect everybody together. But step two, verse 14, I will put my spirit in you and you will live, and I will settle you in your own land. And then you'll know that I am the Lord, that I have spoken and I have done it, declares the Lord. So there's a stage one of a return in unbelief. They're going to come back, but they're not going to have God's spirit in them. We have seen this happen in the last century, beginning in the 1800s, for the last 130 years or so, there has been this massive return to Israel. We have not seen stage two yet. We have not seen them trust in Messiah. In fact, of all the places I've been in the world, I have the least spiritual fruit in Israel of any place I've been and share the gospel with people. My tour guides, when I've been there, there's just a hardening that people just are. I mean, the Muslims are far more open to the gospel than the Jews are, and just about every people are more open than to the Lord. But there's a trust in Messiah that's going to come. There's actually a play on words here. Prophesy to the breath. The word for breath and the word for spirit are actually the same word, believe it or not. In Hebrew, the word ruach can mean breath or wind or spirit. It has all three meanings. You can see the similarity between all three. When Ruach gets translated into Greek, pneuma, believe it or not, it has the exact same three meanings. Breath, wind, or spirit. You see the play on words? He's saying, use your breath to prophesy to the wind, to the breath, and that's going to depict the spirit, the real spiritual life, the real spiritual breath in this nation. And so what we see is the exile to Babylon was going to have a return. I don't think he's talking about them returning to the land shortly after Ezekiel's life, though. I think he's talking about the exile of the nations by the general Titus of the Romans, and they would be returning to the land. I don't want to give into all the details of this, but a lot of people think this is only the first return. It's not really a prophecy of the second return. But they have been back as of 2018 for 70 years now. And it started the first Zionist Congress of 1897, but they had to actually become a nation again. We saw that happen in 1948, and Israel has regained more and more of its ancient borders since then. And the Jews of the world have not grown significantly since 1948. There were about 11 million then. There's about 14 million now. But 11 million of them were outside of Israel in 1948. That was 10 million in 1970, about 7 million now. So nearly half of the Jews that live in the world are actually back in Israel now. Maybe 8 million Jews now. This is 2012. So there's about 15 million Jews, and 8 million are back in the land. Why are they coming back? Because God is the one who's actually working in all of this. But there's an opposition to Israel that's only going to increase. If you hear Benjamin Netanyahu's messages to the UN, you'll see exactly what I'm talking about. He often will talk about this. So much so, and it's going to prosper so much so, Ezekiel 38 and 39 says that there's a nation, Gog, that's going to come and attack Israel. This is called the Battle of Gog and Magog. It's going to be a coalition of nations. Believe it or not, the nations are called Turkey, Russia, and Iran. If you follow the news, you see Erdogan, Putin, and Khomeini actually forming an alliance right now. I think what's going to actually happen in the days ahead, I can't say it's going to be those three people, but it specifically mentions those three nations in Ezekiel 38, verse 2. They just have ancient names for them. Magog, Meshach, Tubal. I think what we're going to have happen is during this tribulation time, there will be this battle of Gog and Magog from Ezekiel 38 to 39. That will precede the Lord's return. We see the names Gog and Magog mentioned in Revelation 20 that are after the millennium. But I don't think we actually have this is not really the same. I think what John's doing in Revelation 20 is he's taking this language and he's applying it, but there's to a battle in the far future. But there are differences between them, and I'll let you look at those on page 512a. Actually, when will it happen? Some people see this as only symbolic, and there's different ideas as to where it's going to occur in relationship to the tribulation. Some say it's going to be only after the millennium or they combine them. But what actually results from it all, we see in the final nine chapters of Ezekiel, 40 to 48, with a restored community. There's four chapters on a new temple, three chapters on new worship, and two chapters on new territories. Yeah, never noticed that. 4, 3, 2, in terms of these nine chapters. the temple here in Ezekiel 40 is has dimensions that are far greater than Solomon's temple. I think it's a temple yet to come. And perhaps we can get into details of that, but we have several other books we need to study. But one of the key points he mentions is that God's glory will return in Ezekiel 43. Remember, God's glory was left there at the Mount of Olives back in chapter 11? Chapter 43 says that God's glory is actually going to enter into the temple from the eastern gate. You can go to the eastern gate now, or at least the upper portion of it, the old eastern gate is down below it. But it says, after this, the man brought me back to the east gate, and suddenly the glory of the God of Israel appeared from the east. And this glory actually enters the east gate. I believe that is yet to come. And the entering the east gate is going to be an amazing picture of God's glory returning to the temple. It's not going to be Solomon's temple. These are on the same scale. You could put four of Solomon's temple inside Ezekiel's temple. This is a huge, huge temple. So much so that many say, well, this is so large, there's no way this could actually be built because it doesn't even fit on present Temple Mount. You're going to have topographical changes. You're going to have mountains coming up and down. But we see other passages actually talking about that. So many say that, oh, that's Solomon's temple. Others say that's the temple of Jesus' time by Herod. I think it's actually, I'm taking it in a literal sense as well. I think it's a literal future temple from Ezekiel's time. It's a millennial temple. Some say it's the church. Some say it's just conditional. It's just, now I realize that to say that there's a temple system yet future, in light of the fact that Jesus has died, especially when you've got sacrifices for sin there, that sounds kind of problematic. I take it that these are a different kind of sacrifice. But if you go the amillennial way, where you say that the temple doors and gates and sizes are, we just spiritualize all of them, you also have a problem. So you have to decide what kind of problem you want. I think just as the pre-cross sacrifices look toward Christ's death, so the post-cross sacrifices will look back at Christ's death. It would be a theocratic, it would be like a confession of sin that we had that looked toward the cross. It would be like confessing sin that looks back. Others will say, no, these are like memorial, like the Lord's Supper is a memorial looking back on Christ's death so that we do this sort of thing. We do see that Paul offered a temple sacrifice in AD 57, some three decades after Jesus' death on the cross. So anyway, I don't know if I'm going to resolve that whole thing. But what we do find is that there's a river that goes from Ezekiel's temple. Starts very, very small. He wades in it in chapter 47. It gets deeper and deeper. And we find that this river is actually right in the middle of the land. Recalling Genesis 15, where God said that he would give Israel this land from the Wadi of Egypt in the south to the Euphrates River in the north. I think Ezekiel 48, the last chapter, actually gives us the fulfillment of when that's actually going to happen. We have all 12 tribes listed here, but they're actually in different order. We have the tribe of Benjamin, for example, south of Judah, whereas before the tribe of Benjamin was north of Jerusalem. We're going to have the people of Judah up here in the north. And if you take these in a normal sense, you'll actually see that millennial Jerusalem retains its central location, but it's on the south side of Judah rather than the north side of Judah. Well, what is all this about? I guess I would sum it up this way. Things are not falling apart. They're falling together. It may look like the world's just an absolute disaster, but God's got his purpose, and God's going to do his own remaking. And perhaps part of it, what he's doing right now, is this Turkey-Iran-Russia alliance that's going on right now as we speak. These three nations are going to turn against Israel. Well, they're already turned against Israel. But there's going to be an alignment of them against Israel. And we actually see the alignment actually happening right now, called the Trilateral Summit that took place in 2018. But there's also plans for a third temple right now. There's a priesthood that's being prepared in Israel. They know who the priests are. There's a red heifer that was born last year. They say a flawless red heifer. These are not conspiracy theories. These are actual things that people actually doing right now in Israel, because the Jews are intent on rebuilding the temple. So there would be a third temple. There has to be a third temple. We're not even talking about the third temple in Ezekiel. We're talking about the fourth temple. I'll address that with... But the third temple is in Daniel 9:27. We talked about last time. Antichrist is going to come in, declare himself to be God, and have an abomination in the temple. For that to happen, you've got to have a temple. You know? But how can we be expectant of God's glory again in our lives, admit that God's glory left, allow God to handle all rivals, and anticipate God's glory to return? Or just to say it in one main idea, expect God to discipline and restore you for his glory. What he does on an individual basis, he's going to do for the whole nation as well. So how do you reveal the glory of God in your life? I mean, I wonder if when we talk about God disciplining us, if can you think of times in your life where the Lord has disciplined you? I can give you some stories of where I've been under God's discipline, and God really got my attention, but then he restored me through it. Do you see his hand in the world today, in world events? Do you think all this is all haphazard? Or do you think God actually is still God over all the nations? And will you return to him so that he can return to you? This concept of wanting to know God's presence in a real sense in our lives, even as believers, is something God has designed in us. And it's the glory, of course, is what it's all about. And the glory for him, not for us. So I trust that you'll see that happen in your own life.